but things that came up. First one was I was curious about the Rocca Association with the moon.
The what association?
Rocca with the moon.
Uh-huh.
Rocca, I think you linked it with Mercury.
Uh-huh.
And if I remember, I mean, is that if I remember when I was going through that before, Rocca was an associated in Parashara.
Is it in the text? Is there a page reference or no?
In your text?
Yeah. I don't know if there's a
reference. No, I don't think so, because you list a lot of that and a lot of, you know, secondary things.
Yeah, it's going to be chapter 3. And so... planet cast, description of the sun, planet deities, complexions, governances. I mean, it's a relatively standard, and I don't know if Parashara gives it.
Just because, I mean, for my own logic, I would more tend to associate Rasa with the moon.
No, no. Go ahead. Go. Share your logic.
No, just because, I mean, it's just how closely connected, you know, the moon is with food and nourishment, and you know how Rasa is that first dhatu that everything else gets developed out of. So you know, that makes more sense to me than Rakta with Mercury, which. Yeah, like I said, like I don't think it's laid out in Parashara, so...
It is. Chapter 3, verse 31.
Let me go grab my copy. Okay, well...
But look at the terminology there. And it's important. It's an important differentiation.
Yeah.
And if we look at the Sanskrit versus the translation, we also, you know, how the author translated certain words. I'll wait till you have your copy out.
Yeah, I've got my copy.
It's just 31, that's it?
Verse 31, chapter 3. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And first word is asti. Second word is rakta. Then we have maja. Then we have twak. And so he's basically saying bones, blood, marrow, skin are associated with the planets in the order of the weekdays from sun onwards. So yeah. Asti, sun, Rakta, moon, Maja, Tuesday, Mars, skin, Mercury, Wednesday. and so here we're seeing that he's not using the same Ayurvedic system that's in Charaka.
Yeah.
But if you look at Upadhatus, which Upadhatu has skin, which major dhatu has skin as Upadhatu?
Rasa, well, the top layer goes to Rasa, yeah.
Exactly. So the skin is directly associated with the rasa. And when Mercury gets disturbed, it literally shows up, you know, when Mercury's conjunct Mars, and sometimes combust with Sun or with both of them, you'll see inflammations in the skin.
I've got that in my chart, and I've got it in my life.
and I know somebody with that.
Mm-hmm. Really good remedies for that are in Volume 2, in the section on for Saturn. It talks about Saturn in the different houses, the different trines, and it gives four different Vishnu mantras. Om Hrim Vishnave Namaha, Om Shrim Vishnave Namaha, Om Klim Vishnave Namaha, and Om Shrim Vishnave Namaha. So when that Mercury becomes so hot by taking the right trine, using that mantra of Vishnu, it helps on an energetic level bring in the cooling, clearing energy. If somebody is a more elaborate sadhaka, you can also recommend Vishnu Sahasranam. But you know, how many people can chant Vishnu Sahasranam? So Om Vishnave Namaha or Om Shrim Vishnave Namaha works normally better.
Are there like specific reasons for choosing one or the other? And would somebody like you need to be the one to make that choice?
Nope. It's the rules are in Volume 2.
Okay.
It's based upon the trine that the Mercury is falling in.
You referenced Saturn there.
Exactly. But a lot of, particularly in the realm of health, Saturn and Mercury, that Om Vishnave Namaha and Om Narayanaya Namaha can be used interchangeably for Mercury or Saturn. So if Saturn's in one of those trines suffering, you can use that remedy, as well as Mercury afflicted, you can use that remedy. The thing with that one is you wouldn't use it for Mercury if Mercury wasn't afflicted.
The person I know has Mercury, Sun, Venus in the Lagna in the first house, and she's got Saturn and Jupiter retrograde in the fifth house.
Mm-hmm.
So okay. Would you consider that an ailing Saturn?
No.
Okay.
As we talked the other day, I don't see Saturn, Jupiter-Saturn conjunction is not that negative.
And even though it's retrograde?
Even though it's retrograde.
Okay.
Jupiter-Rahu with Jupiter retrograde, that's bad stuff. I mean, that's what we have going on right now in the sky.
Exactly.
And look at Donald Trump. That is the fuel of Donald Trump right now.
That could end up being very positive.
The thing is, luckily by election time, Jupiter and Rahu aren't conjunct anymore. So this impetus that Trump is gathering with Jupiter Rahu together, he won't have when the final election happens.
The only question, I don't want to interrupt with my questions on top of his, but it's related to
As long as it's on the same topic, then jump in.
Yeah. Because after yesterday, I still had a question. Well, as you were saying in the class, a retrograde planet is following Rahu or Kate Rahu,
mm-hmm.
but it's not following the sun or the moon if it was not retrograde. And so when you were saying a retrograde planet is three times stronger, that sounded positive, but the retrograde not following the sun and moon doesn't sound positive. So is that the positive and the not so positive?
Remember, everything is both, right? Think about when you get stubborn about something. If you're stubborn about something good, stubborn about somebody who was
doing
trying
your sadhana.
Doing your sadhana. Stubborn about your sadhana. It's a wonderful thing to be stubborn about. stubborn about eating a food that you shouldn't eat is going to kill you.
Really?
So
I like that.
But you know, so stubborn, you know, that three times as strong, it kind of really makes the planet isn't listening to anybody else. It's not listening to the authority. It's not listening, you know, it's doing what it wants to do. And that can sometimes be good, and it can sometimes be horrendous.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when somebody doesn't listen to their parents and goes off and does their own thing, you know, if their parents were telling them to this morning, I had a woman, you know, she told her daughter, you should get an education in something that you can make money. Her daughter just wanted to learn how to make jewelry. Her daughter went, studied jewelry making, and now has a job where she makes jewelry, has full health insurance, makes more than her mom does as a nurse, making jewelry. So that was a place where her being stubborn about what she wanted was, in the end, beneficial. You know what I mean? So not listening to the sun and moon, not listening to mom and dad, worked out for her in that situation.
That's a great explanation. Thank you.
You're welcome. All right, Frank.
Okay. Next.
So, hold on. So let's see. Let me go more into this Rakta and Rasa a little bit.
Okay.
So Rakta with the moon.
Yes.
We're looking at the actual substance of the blood. And when we say substance of the blood, when I say, when you look at your dad and your brothers and your uncles and, you know, and your great-grandfather who was something, you know, whatever ones you appreciate in your past, and you say, yes, that's my blood. You mean that's my bloodline. And then you're talking about the moon. So the moon is showing that family bloodline lineage.
Mm.
And the moon is thereby showing the genetics. And there's that nice little thing that's hidden in that where consciousness, your emotional state, affects the genetics. It is affecting your bloodline, you know, the state of the mind. And so the moon is the blood in this deeper sense. And there's this whole relationship between moon and Saturn. And if we look at the numerology, the moon takes how many days to in a synodic cycle?
29 whatever point.
29 and a half, basically.
Yeah.
And Saturn takes how many years to go around the zodiac?
28-ish.
about 29 and a half.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Same thing. So there's this synodic cycle of the moon that correlates to the larger cycle of Saturn. And if you look in the Panchanga, that Saturn is the planet ruling the nakshatras when it comes to tattva. I don't know if you know that. That it's in chapter 15. We talk about that. So there's this whole kind of connection that's happening between moon, prana, vayu, Saturn that's going on. And so when we look at the actual Rakta, what is, you know, it's actually the hemoglobin. And the hemoglobin is iron. And iron is Saturn. So there's this whole composition of Saturn within the Rakta.
There's some correlation with prana here too, as far as Rakta and configuration.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, how's that Rakta? How's the Rakta get red? Through breathing and prana in the lungs,
yeah.
You know?
Okay.
So that whole Vayu, there's this whole Saturn moon connection that it shows up in the skies above, and it shows up biologically as well.
I have a question related to this.
Okay, related to that, because and then I'm going to go into Rasa to really to show him the yes.
Okay, you were talking about how now I get put on the spot. You're pressured. I can't. You were talking about how moon and Saturn. When there's a moon-Saturn like aspect, that's related to past karma with the mother.
Anything with
not treating the mother well in the past.
Anything with the moon is related to the mother.
But I mean, the Saturn aspect on the moon, the grief, the sadness that comes from past karma, right?
At the same time, if Jupiter was with the moon, then it would be joy and happiness coming from past karma with the mother.
But it's kind of interesting that you're talking about Saturn and the moon and the connection between the nakshatras, I mean.
Yeah, well, they basically, and it's like not even... It's something that you just notice. It's already there. It's not something that I'm creating. It's something that when you look at the numerology, they're naturally relating.
So Saturn takes care of...
And Saturn is in
a... Karma for mistreatment with the mother in the past.
All planets. You can't just differentiate with that. Any planet connected to the moon is karma with mother in the past. Any planet, okay. not just here. I'm relating the functional aspect of Saturn and moon. Saturn is in a sign for how long is Saturn in each sign?
2.5 years.
How long is the moon in a sign?
2.5 days.
Uh-huh. So, you know, am I making that up or is that... You just told me that they're the same. 2.5 days, 2.5 years. So.
Well, how does Sati Sati tie into that?
Say again?
How does Sati Sati tie into that?
Well, it's Saturn over the moon.
Right.
Yeah, so it is that. You're just looking at that connection of the Saturn and the moon.
But I mean, like... The result of Sati Sati for a person.
That's just transit. You could do the transit of Jupiter over the moon and look at when somebody's going to have good luck, just like you look at this transit of Saturn over the moon for when they're going to have bad luck. You can look at the transit of Venus over the moon for when they're going to get a crush on somebody. or like this. So anything over the moon, the significations of that planet are going to be influencing it. All right. So let's jump into the rasa of Mercury. And so rasa, the place in the Hindu tradition where rasa is most taught, where we find the tradition of the intricacies of rasa, are in the realm of the theater. In the theatrical texts, there is huge discourses on emotions and rasa and the fact that there's 9 of them and how each of them are acting and what the facial expressions of them are and how to invoke that in another person. And so there's this, you know, with emotions, because rasa also means emotion. Mm. And rasa also means flavor. And you know, when we translate it into English, they become different things. But when we think in Sanskrit, the flavor of something is its emotion. We don't differentiate them.
Is it like bhava?
Bhava. Bhava is preceding rasa.
Hmm.
When the bhava, when I get angry, you look, when somebody gets angry, you see the forehead gets scrunched, the fists grind up, the jaws go up, the teeth come out. That's the bhava. The anger that I'm feeling emotionally, that's the rasa. Now, when you get angry and I get angry and Frank gets angry, all of us do the same bhava. We all, the physical body will react the same, but the rasa will be different in each of us. Because when you get angry, how you act versus when I get angry, how I act versus when Frank gets angry, how he acts, there's a difference between us.
Because of our planetary.
Exactly. So the rasa is different between us, but the bhava will be the same. The bhava is this the word I translate it when we're talking about emotion theory, it's translated as affect, where rasa becomes emotion.
I was going to say it's what you're feeling in the heart, not necessarily your heart chakra, but in some fourth micro chakra. It's like
the Western terminology would be affect.
Okay.
So we can see that the emotion and taste, that, you know, yes, when we translate it into English, they're two different things, but they're not two different things in Sanskrit. And when we look at that flow that's moving through us, that's moving through the lymph, that's moving through our veins, it's that emotion, it's that flavor for who we are. And that flavor for who we are, it shows up. It's something that can't be hidden. We can hide our emotions, but we can't hide our affects. When you get angry, or let's say you gave somebody some news and it made them sad. When you give them the news, you'll see their face take on a sad disposition. And then you say, "Are you okay?" And they might say, "Oh, I'm fine. I'm just going to go take a walk right now. I'm nothing wrong with, you know, I'm just fine." And so their emotion, they might not be sharing a sad emotion, but their affect was sad. So the affects can't be hidden. And when we look at Mercury, Mercury's the doorway. He's the communicator. So this affect, this emotion, this flavor is communicating. And when we look at the skin, that the energy that's going into Mercury gets communicated through the skin. The skin is communicating our inner health, our inner well-being.
Expressing.
It's expressing. You know, the skin is expressing whether we want it to express or not. So does that make a little more sense of
yeah,
why?
Yeah.
Okay.
Totally. That's a huge help. I've been chewing on that for a little bit.
and you see, and so you see how Parashara, you know, he says twak, but, you know, by skin, he means the rasa dhatu.
Yeah. Okay. The next little question I had, you went through the ages of the planets and you have a little chart.
Mm-hmm.
You had Mars as being year 1 through 6.
Mm. 1 through 6? Hold on. Give me... No.
Yeah.
What page is that?
It's not one...
It is...
He's 3 to 6. Or 2 to 6.
But... And so with Sanjay, he was teaching 1 to 3, I believe.
Oh, okay. Well, that's another. Let me. What was the page
that
number?
Is?
Oh, it's page 73.
Thank you.
All right. And yeah, four. He was saying 1 to 3, huh?
Yeah.
Yeah. Basically, Mars is ruling the primary toddlerhood until preschool starts. And when preschool starts, you know, there's that cultural variation. If we look at Waldorf, they'll probably say 6. If we go to India, you know, some places train them a little earlier. Some places it's around 6 where they get their alphabet diksha. In America, it's 5 when kids start preschool.
Kindergarten.
Kindergarten. Exactly.
Preschool can start at 3 years old.
So basically, it's from toddlerhood once they start walking, because the moon rules until they start walking. When they're crawling, they're moon. As soon as they start walking, then they've entered Mars. And mm-hmm. Mars runs, and so, and when we're going to talk, there's a slight difference between Nisargika Dasha and then natural, like 100% biological natural rulership. But Mercury starts when the kid starts learning.
Learning what? Academics?
Yeah, they start learning
academics.
Intellectual stuff.
What do you mean intellectual? I mean,
you know,
writing and that, or I mean,
they're learning how to write, learning how to right. to read these kind of, you know, learning their math.
And so you're saying these ages are different from Nisargika calculations?
They're coming from Nisargika.
Yeah, yeah. So they should line up then.
What's Nisargika?
Just the natural ages of the planets and how it's in the second volume more, but it's briefly explained here on 73, but all the different ages of the planets have different,
you know, oh, I have a question related to that. Yeah.
And there's a whole timing system that goes along with it.
Yeah. In the direct Nisargika, it's 1-3.
Yeah. Okay.
As given by Parashara.
Okay. That title then, or is that just a...
No. How can I say? It's there's a few different opinions, uh-huh. and when we're not using straight Nisargika dasha, whether it's 3, 4, or 6, there's a difference of opinion in different texts,
mm-hmm.
and where that becomes important for us really. If we're not using Nisargika dasha, is for the moon and Mars natural period, if there is something wrong with the child, it's the mother that does the remedy.
Mm-hmm.
And once they enter Mercury, it's the father that does the remedy.
You mean the father, they don't administer the remedy to the child, but they actually do the remedy.
Yeah, like let's say yeah. the child is suffering from leukemia and the remedy is Mrityunjaya mantra. So if the child is 4 years old and, you know, they have leukemia, it would be the mother would sit down and would say, I offer this Mrityunjaya to you, and would sit down and do the Mrityunjaya mantra. Where once we enter the Mercury period, then it becomes the father that does the mantra for the child. And once they hit the puberty, then it becomes their own karma to take care of. Which in some texts is actually, some texts say 8, some texts say 12, you know, 12 as puberty.
Yeah.
And the texts that say 8, you know, that's coming from the more the Brahmanical concept where the boy is getting his Sandhya Vandana or his Gayatri initiation at age 8. And so at that point he's considered to be in charge of his own karma. And so wow. that's where it's you know making a that's where it's gonna make a difference.
Is that cultural or is that like in the old days? I mean
Exactly. You know, it's like at what age in our culture is a kid going to be in charge of his own decisions? You know, is he karmically responsible for his decisions in our culture? And I think...
32?
Say again?
I was joking. 32.
I think in our culture it's puberty.
Yeah.
I think it's more like 17, 18.
No, if a 15-year-old steals something, it's their karma, not their parents' karma.
I guess it's kind of individual.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, ready to take responsibility.
There's ready to take responsibility, and then there's earning the fruit of your actions.
Earning the fruit of actions.
If you steal something, if you hit somebody... If, you know, I mean, at puberty, a boy can get a girl pregnant. And it's not the, you know, at that point, like, is it the parents? It might have been the parents' responsibility, but it is the karma of that child. But any which way, so that you can, you know, a whole discussion can be in that realm.
Yeah, it's flipped. Okay, that's fine.
In modern research, it's very interesting in this realm, which I talk about it in the Nisargika chapter of, you know, volume 2. but a little bit. I don't talk too much. I do more just a correlation in that chapter. If we look at the both Freudian and Erikson developmental theories, they're using and Freud stops at Venus, you know. At 32, he sees it as done. When we look at Erikson basically goes all the way to the Saturn Nisarga Dasha. The big difference with them is both Erikson and Freud, they're, you know, if we have Mars stop at 3 and we start Mercury at 3 to puberty, they're breaking that 3 to puberty into two different periods.
Mm-hmm.
The thing is, both of those periods...
What are they called?
Off the top of my head, the second half is called industrial, and I think the first half is called, I can't remember what it's called, but it's related to being happy with what they're accomplishing. Like, they're actually accomplishing something and they're happy about it. Where on the second half, they're being industrial, where they're taking their own initiative to make things happen. And so they divide that Mercury period into two different halves. Now, whether, you know, Karak has changed or whether both of those could fall under the energy of Mercury is a another discussion. But one of the wonderful, the thing with Freud is I think Freud is taking some of the, because the Greeks use this same system. You know that, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I think Freud is just taking the Greek system and just putting his psychological philosophy on top of it. With Erikson, it's statistical research. He takes kids, they research them, they look at their skills. When do they develop this skill? When do they develop that skill? What's changing in their focus at these different ages? And so, you know, the fact that he really took it through the rigor of scientific method to kind of really show that these are solid time periods of consciousness where we're developed differently.
Well, they were different. They had different roles. You know, yeah. Erikson was so deep and he was so, he was more of a researcher, where I think Freud was more of the therapist type. You know what I mean?
At the same time, Freud came up with the root theory behind everything. So... You
but
know.
Erikson did too.
Erikson was building on Freud, though.
He was.
Oh yeah,
I didn't know that.
He was. You know, he had everything that Freud had done to build on top of, and he took Freud deeper, threw some of Freud's stuff out, added some stuff in. So he didn't just take it deeper, but he really, you know, he really
refined it.
Refined Freud. And the crazy thing is that there's the hardcore Freudians, they don't care who refines anything. They just want to believe Freud, which to me is kind of crazy. But when we look at
guru.
What Eric's, huh?
Guru.
Exactly. It's the guru issue. But when we look at when we look at deeper at at Erikson's work, it really and I don't know if you know who I'm talking about, Frank. Eric Erikson.
I know the net by name. I haven't read much of his work.
If you read his developmental stuff, he brings what these ages are. He gives such depth to them. It's amazing, and everything he says directly. You can just keep these same karakas and act like, you know, it's coming right out of a Jyotish text.
Steiner does that too. And Steiner, you were right on with Steiner, what you were saying about, you know, the 7 years old and things. Steiner is really in depth.
And so, you know, one of the ways we can use this is when one of these planets becomes really afflicted, it's going to show it's going to show itself in that age. And if you look at one of the things that Erikson does is he talks about when a child successfully accomplishes that age and what happens when they don't successfully accomplish that age. That's one of the things that he explains that no one else actually goes into that level of depth with. And so it actually, like, he sits there and, like, he says, well, if you've accomplished this 0 to 1, this is what you're like. And if you don't accomplish this is what you're like. And literally you can sit there and say, if the moon is strong, this is what the person's like. If the moon is weak, this is what they're like. Like, you can take his same terminology and totally apply it on the Jyotish perspective. And you get some really deep psychological readings of what's going on in people based on just looking at their chart, seeing the planetary strengths, and seeing what ages were developed well and which ones weren't.
So when you're dealing with Moon and Scorpio, and you're meeting somebody who's 60 or 70 years old, that's not the picture. Yeah.
Well,
I have someone like that, and
just Moon and Scorpio. It needs to be Moon and Scorpio afflicted, either Moon and Scorpio in 6, 8, or 12. Or Moon and Scorpio with the aspect of two malefics.
This is third house.
Uh-huh. The third house is not as bad. So, you know, there's...
She suffers a lot. She suffers. I mean, she has a lot of brilliance, but she emotionally, she has like a broken leg. You know, it's hard.
And so literally, if you go and you look up what Erik Erikson says for that 0 to 1 age and what didn't get met and how to handle it, you have her remedy for her moon right there.
Okay. She was so relieved to find out that her moon is in, you know, with the situation. That is like, thank you.
Yeah. All right. Next, Frank.
Next.
And hold on. Did that clarify that zone?
Yeah. No, that was good. And yeah, look up Erikson. And there's other systems too by a lot of Western psychologists too, if I'm not mistaken, like Piaget or somebody, and
yeah, but
some of these
other
guys.
The thing is do they fit in with Jyotish, or are they contrasting, or are they overlapping? The thing with Erik Erikson is
you always study Erikson. He's the biggest, most important in the beginning theorist, right?
Yeah, and Piaget is a cognitive therapist.
Mm-hmm.
You could almost say he's directly dealing with Mercury and the Lagnesha.
He didn't deal with that with all the early stages.
He did early stage thinking. He showed how the cognitive is developing. Where with Erikson, he's showing the cognition, the emotion, the functioning. It's a little bit more of a holistic discussion there.
And like the whole relationship with the mother, the whole trust, mistrust, you know.
Which you won't get in Piaget.
Yeah. But Piaget studied his own kids.
Erikson studied thousands of children, so there's a huge body of evidence behind him. So just to differentiate, that Erikson stands out for Nisarga Dasha.
Okay, yeah, no, it's on my list.
and there's others, but which ones correlate where, you know? Like some of those, I think Piaget, if I had to correlate him somewhere, I'd correlate him to Shadbala of Mercury. You know?
The strength of Mercury?
Uh-huh. Just as a differentiation there, you know.
Yeah. Well, one of the bigger questions I had was the whole idea of combining the guna, the sign, and the intrinsic nature of the sign versus the objective of the sign.
Yep.
I mean, I've heard Sanjay talk about that too, but I just. Applying that to charts and actually using that, and you know, which
applying it and using it. So,
it might be a big question.
And really, there's so many techniques that you know where we're bringing in gunas, and I don't know if I have a good way to tell you when to use which, but there's certain periods where the guna that we're looking at is based upon the sign. or, you know, it's based on intrinsic. And then there's certain techniques where the guna were looking at the planet itself, you know. So which techniques and which aspect we're looking at, it really changes relative to the technique. And at the top of my tongue, I can't say I have a thumb rule for differentiating when to use which, but most of the time it's like in a text, it will often say based upon dual movable fixed. And, you know, they're talking about the guna, but like we know they're talking about the guna based upon the sign, Lord. And then there's the next few rules, and we know that they're still continuing along that same concept. So, yeah.
Don't worry about it too much.
Say again?
So don't worry about it too much for now.
Yeah, you know, it's. I mean, you know, as techniques come up, we'll discuss. So.
Okay.
The only thing around that I found hard to kind of gel is the tamasic nature of Mars and how rajasic the fire element is, you know. And it's like
how rajasic or how tamasic? How rajasic or how tamasic, you're saying?
Well, it's a tamasic planet. Yeah. Yet Aries is so action oriented and Mars is so fiery, and so I've had a hard time. I'm gonna have to. That's a new thing for me to integrate.
But then I mean, look at Scorpio though. It's a tamasic planet and a tamasic sign.
And it's water, a fiery planet in water. It's hard
Don't when we're talking gunas, don't mix in tattvas.
Okay.
Because then you'll confuse yourself.
Yeah, that's what's happening.
and because when we're talking about gunas, we're really, you could almost say we're talking about the psychology before it even manifests into the physical body. And
like a quality.
As soon as you start adding in tattvas, then you're at a third level of what the planet's representing. When we have the discussion about guna, you know, like, I mean, for example, Aries, you know, because of its tamas and rajas mix, its end result is sattvic. So Aries is giving us this sattvic effect, which, you know, it makes a very clear reasoning of why Sun, you know, is so strong there in Aries, you know, because the Sun, it's this krur graha, but it's sattvic. And so it's this, you know, more intense sign, but yet it's sattvic. It's fully supporting the sun's nature. What else there, Frank?
I noticed your the D9, the deity list for your D9 on page 128. You start with minutia, but didn't it start go day? Shasa, or Deva, Manusha, and then Rakshasa?
That should be right out of Parashara.
Yeah, but it seems mixed in your text.
You're telling me that I'm not agreeing with Parashara?
Might be a typo, but yeah, it's not lining up here. So. Seems like pretty straightforward, so.
Let's see. It's possible that there's a typo, but let's see. If I look at, and I mean, instead of trying to dig it up right now out of Parashara, I'm just going to open, let's see, I'm going to open your chart, Frank. And so if we look at do we have a planet in the first Navamsha?
Uh,
No, but we have a planet in the second, Lugna's second Navamsa, right?
Yeah.
Okay. So second Navamsa, that's telling us that, okay, so second Navamsa, and if we just go to Umsha rulers, Lugna is Rakshasa.
I can't put the sweater on.
And that's what I have it as here, Rakshasa.
Okay.
Let's see. Go back to, a planet that is, let's do your moon. Your moon is 1831, which would mean we're in the 1640 to 1959 Navamsa. That's telling us Devata, right? So I look at Umsha rulers for moon. It's saying Rakshasa again. Oh, because I'm not looking at the right Rashi. Okay. So it's moon in the, that of the sign is Aries. All right, so it should be Devata, and I'm saying it's Rakshasa. And let's see if we have Lugna there. Did I look right? It was in Scorpio first. It should be Manusha. So you're right. There is a mistake there.
I'm not crazy.
Page one. I'm surprised you noticed, though, the detail oriented.
I actually went through and did all the charts and all that.
Yeah. So,
and nice. Sanjay had some few things on it, and I was referencing.
Yeah.
Get us lining up. So.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a typo of some nature there. All right. So, okay. Typo, what else do we got going on?
I'm curious about the nodes.
Okay.
And
give me a page reference where you're working.
Just looking at something like exaltation or debilitation, mm-hmm.
Which I think I make a note depending what version of the book you have.
Which 71, that's on that page. But I'm curious more of, when one node is exalted, the other one's getting exalted.
Yes.
So they're both.
Exactly.
So I mean, is that just how we're reading them? They're both.
They're either both exalted or they're both debilitated, and in that way, it's showing that we're always reading the nodes as a unit. We're reading them as an axis that's giving a beneficial result or a negative result. We're not reading them as, okay, Rahu's good, Ketu's bad, or one's strong and one's not. It's we're reading them as a unit of they're creating a polarity in a chart, and they're either going to be doing it in a beneficial way or a not beneficial way. Though, when you get the Nietzsche Bungas, you can have one of them getting Nietzsche Bunga, but not the other one.
But there's no way to see if like one's stronger than the other, or giving more results, or something like that, or it's just take them as a package.
In which way?
That's how I looked at it before. Just straight like, okay, they're both strong now or weak or whatever. But it just felt like there might be some differentiation for some reason. I don't know.
Get clearer on your question.
It's not a clear question. No question. Come on.
Freedom, to me, it seems to relate to what we were talking about with how my K2 can get me out of my Rahu problem. That the 10th house will help. Focusing on K2 will help.
But that's only because of Argala. If you're looking at the 5 and 11, then it's going to be different.
Yeah. Oh, I thought it was because of the nodes.
Yeah. Well, it's because the nodes are in a 4-10 axis. And so the 4-10 from whichever house they're influencing is they're having that impact. But that's not going to always be from Lagna. That's going to change depending on the axis, which we'll cover when we do Argala.
Oh, okay.
Yes. What about the, you're not asking me about the difference between the Taurus and the Gemini exaltation, though. You understand that difference?
Roughly enough to, you know, not, I mean, probably not as deeply as you, but.
Well, go ahead and explain to me the difference.
Well, one of them is more for the material, one's more for health kind of concerns in the chart, right? I mean, that's the basic idea behind it.
But what about the difference between Rahu and Ketu? You know, with Rahu, one is in Taurus, one is in Gemini, but look at what happens with Ketu. With the Ayush exaltation, Ketu's in Scorpio, so it's Swakshetra. And we don't have any degrees to say, well, where is it Swakshetra and where is it exalted? Where, you know, with some of these other signs, like, for example, Virgo, we have a differentiation of 0 to 15 is Ucha, and 15 to 20 is Mula Trikona. And 20 to 30 is Swakshetra. But then when we get to Scorpio, there's none of the texts are giving us a differentiation. So is it exalted or is it swa?
Is that because it rules the house?
Because it's co-lord of Scorpio.
The sign, yeah.
And now the big thing is, if it's swa, then it's giving us the number 2. If it's ucha, it's giving us the number 3. So let's say you have a K2 in Scorpio in the fifth house, or K2 in Scorpio, let's say K2 in Scorpio in the fourth house of the D4. Does the person have 2 homes or do they have 3 homes?
At that point, it doesn't matter.
Well, it does. It does. They come and they're like, they have... You know, if they have one house and they're like, I'm thinking of buying a rental to make more money, you say, yes. You know, then they have 2 and they come and they say, you know, should I buy a rental or should I invest in the stock market or some other investment? And you know, they already have 2. You see that many indicated because we want to have the houses that are being indicated in the D4. That way there's a balance happening. When we throw out the natural imbalance, then yeah, any which way. Unless there's an exaltation, it's, you know, if there's an exaltation, let them have 10. If it's just swa, you know, more than 2 could become unwieldy for them. And then they could lose all of them. Any which way. So you know, I'm just shooting you asked a question, you were an unclear question, I asked you a clear one.
I don't know the answer to that one.
now what if Rahu and Ketu are in the Taurus Scorpio axis
Rahu's in Taurus? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, the Rahu-Taurus axis, but Gemini. We'll just leave it at that. I was just going to talk about Nietzsche Bunga rules, but all right. And any other questions there, Frank? Give me something specific.
I just got a couple like historical questions.
Mm-hmm.
How Parashara is linked to like Vashishta, right? As far as, you know, being connected through
mythologically, you know, within the tradition, Parashara is the grandson of Vashishta.
That's more because Vashishta was also Ram's guru.
Yes.
So. When they talk about that, is that seen from more of the mythological standpoint, or, you know, looking And I mean, historically, you know, if that's the case, then you're dating Kirashira to around, you know, 3000-ish. I mean, Ram was supposed to have lived, you know, yugas ago, you know?
So. Oh, but Vasishta's, you know, he's one of those original rishis. So he's got a few, you know, his life is measured in millennias. You know, how many millennia is he alive? You know, and because if we get into the mythological realm, you know, in Vasishta's time, people had huge lifespans. Once we get to Parashura's, Parashura was just before the age of Kali Yuga, so you know he was in where people lived to be 1,000, and then comes our age where people live to be 100.
So you're suggesting Vasishta lived that long through Ram through Parashura?
That is the mythology, yes.
Okay.
And you know, that's the mythological lore. And in between, you know about in between, right? Parashura's father? It's so funny. Once I was searching for something online about Parashura's father, and I found this quote on some like weird Hindu website, and I start reading it, and I'm like, "Wow, this guy's he found this is so well written." And like, and then I was like, "Wait a minute, I wrote that. They just took that from my website and put it on theirs." Oh my goodness! But it's so funny. I was reading. I was like, "Oh yeah, exactly." Just talk, and then yeah,
I like that.
Oh my goodness! But Parashura's father, his name was Shakti, and one day he was walking through this garden, and this king was disrespectful to him. And, you know, he's like, "I'm a rishi, the son of Vasishta. How dare you?" And the king's like, "Rishi, son, whatever, you know, like." And so Shakti took his magic. He said, "Well, screw you," and turned him into a demon. He said, "You think you're a king? Well, look at this, you know," and turned him into this big ogre of a demon. And so the king, being a big ogre of a demon, said, "Oh, yeah," and ate him. So Parashura's father was eaten by a demon, but but one that he made. And so in the beginning, I don't know if it's Vishnu Purana. It might be the very beginning of Vishnu Purana, and it discusses, and so Parashura, because he's pissed that his dad got eaten by a demon, says, "Okay, these demons, how dare they? I'm going to destroy all the demons." And he sat down, did a sacrifice, and he started doing a puja to destroy all the demons in the universe. And he starts doing his puja. Demons start dying. He's destroying the demons. And Vasishta, his father, comes and he says, "Listen, demons are part of the natural order. You don't destroy them. It's you know, what your father did is what you did. You got to forgive. The demons are here. It's their karma to do what demons do, and it's our dharma to have compassion to all things." And so Parashura stopped his puja of destroying all the demons. And I think it's the very beginning of Vishnu Purana it tells that story. But it's quite interesting if we look at what is the psychological, the inner interpretation of all that? That, you know, you can't destroy all the darkness, that these dark creatures, they exist and they have a purpose as well.
Well, it reminds me of what you say.
Exactly.
Between Mars and Mercury, or Mars and Jupiter. Jupiter won't destroy, it'll convert. Mm-hmm. And it does it gracefully, whereas Mars is just ugly.
That, and it's you know, that and really learning to accept all sides of things. That the rishi doesn't destroy all evil. The rishi learns to love all things. That slight difference. But yeah, so that's what the texts tell us. And
yeah, two.
Yeah.
And
time warps, you know, in the different yugas, time is working different. So, you know, before 3200 BC, you know, we had a whole different yuga happening. And Parashara was a rishi of that yuga time period. He was here for the very beginning of Kali Yuga, but he's not a Kali Yuga rishi.
Then I was curious if I know you referenced, and I've been curious about this, but how some of the ancient texts reference the earth going around the sun.
Say this again.
Just some of the ancient texts referencing the earth going around the sun and them having knowledge of that, you know, thousands of years ago.
Well, do they say, I mean, one of the Brahmanas, it makes the statement that the sun never sets, you know, it's only that we don't see its course. And there's an argument, well, can you say that that means we're going around it or it's going around us? But it's a clear reference that the earth is round and that, you know, how the sun is working in its motion. Some of those arguments are a little, you know, that depends on interpretation. When we look at some of the other calculations as well, on a certain level, without a proper understanding, it becomes very difficult to do the mathematics.
Is the sun moving?
Relative to the earth or relative to the galaxy?
Relative to the galaxy.
Yes, it's moving at millions of miles an hour.
And so that means we are too?
Exactly. So we're not just moving around the sun, but we're literally, as the sun, just like the moon is revolving around the earth as the earth moves, we're revolving around the sun and the sun is moving millions of miles an hour.
But from the earth's point of view, the sun isn't moving.
From the earth's point of view, it depends how you want to look at it. Because if we look over time, if we had, you know, if we look at, if there's proper records every 1,000 years of where things are at certain time periods, you would be able to notice the motion that the sun has against the background of the stars. So whether we're calculating it,
to this moment we don't see the subtlety.
Yeah, the subtle, because it's such a big thing that, you know, in one lifetime you wouldn't be able to notice the motion.
Yeah.
Because the sun might be moving millions and millions of miles an hour, but it's trillions and trillions and trillions of miles that the galaxy is distances from each other. In volume 2, I do a little mathematics on that. In the yuga section, actually. Yeah, Frank.
So you're saying with these calculations of Earth going around, so it's more of an extrapolation of what's in the text, and I mean, there's not necessarily concrete.
Is there something that says the Earth moves around the sun? There is something, and I don't know the exact verse, but there's somewhere where Varaha Mihira makes fun of people that believe that the Earth goes around the sun.
Okay.
He says, ha ha, they think it does that, the fools. You know, luckily we don't make fun of him because we, you know, he didn't have a telescope. But there is a verse where he mentions that there are people that have that belief. But off the top of my head, I don't know of a place that actually makes that statement. Unfortunately, what happened after Varaha Mihira is because he became so popular, the things that he supported, they actually stayed around, and some of the texts that he didn't support disappeared. And so, you know, the fact that he's like, oh, look, these guys believe the earth goes around the sun, that's not true. So everything that didn't believe that, like, stayed. And the things that, like, actually supported that theory, they got laughed at. Oh, Varaha Mihira said you guys are fools. And so, you know, the traditional text didn't have the support to remain. And I don't know if you know about, you know, some of the burning of the libraries during the between basically the 8th to the 11th century, the majority of North Indian libraries were burned by the Muslims.
Yeah, and I know there's been a vast amount lost. Yeah,
but very specific. I mean, there's records of the burn. There's records of, like, how many texts were in the, you know, there's, like, a list in the Buddhist texts. They list it. How many math books? How many astrology books? How many Ayurveda books? Like, they had these lists of what was in the library. And they say that, like, the library at Nalanda, it took the Muslims just taking the books and throwing them into a pile that was burning. It took them 3 days to burn all the books. They had a whole army throwing the books in a pile to burn, and it took them 3 days.
It hurts.
So you know, like, which what books were burned at that point, and then which ones were in people's homes that were able to survive. And what we have are the books that were in people's homes. That's what's made it through. Otherwise, the Muslims would have destroyed everything. And some people, there's a thing in academia that now says, you know, well, the Muslims also supported the arts. And the big thing is, you know, if we look from 800 to 1100, there was one or two kings who in their reign supported the arts. But when we look at the majority of Mughal rulers and conquerors, the majority were just destroyed everything that wasn't Islamic. And so I can't support this academic view. Oh, don't be so hard on Islam. They also supported things. I kind of think, and just from my personal opinion, that, you know, a lot of those scholars are Christians and Americans and colonialists who, you know, mm-hmm. if you look at somebody who's a British person who came to America and you're responsible for a complete genocide of Native Americans, then you sit there and you say, oh, the Muslims, let's not be too hard on them. You know, it's easy to say, let's not be too hard on them when you have the own shadow of completely having genocide of an indigenous culture.
Mm-hmm.
When we remove, hey, let's just be honest, you know, as European Americans, we did genocide to the indigenous people of the Americas. And the Muslims did genocide to the culture and people of Pakistan, Afghanistan, and northern India. End of story, you know? It was physical and cultural genocide. But any which way. So you know, that was a long spiel, but Varahamihira, he mentions that these people have this view.
But all of that is still, I mean, it's all condoned in that realm. That's how they opt. It's still going on.
Yeah,
it's
still going on.
Play.
Varahamihira also supported Surya Siddhanta over Vasishta Siddhanta. And when, you know, I read a technical paper, and if you look at the astronomical calculations in Vasishta Siddhanta compared to Surya Siddhanta, Vasishta Siddhanta is actually more accurate. But Surya Siddhanta became the number one Siddhanta because it had the seal of approval of Varahamihira.
Mm-hmm.
And so you never hear anybody talking about Vasishta Siddhanta. And there's no study projects about it. There's no, but you know, it was an article by a particular scientist who actually compared the texts. And he showed that there, it was much more technically advanced, the Vasishta Samhita. I have that. Yeah. Anyway. All right. Frank is filled with these questions, so we'll give him a few more minutes, and then we'll go into some of yours. Okay.
I got one last one, and I'll shut up.
Only one last one. You got to. Yes. Okay. Go ahead.
Unless, Yama, you got a burning question.
No, I don't.
So, curious, when we look at, Friend's House, debilitation, all that,
mm-hmm.
how we can reason or look at, you know, if Mars being, for one example, like Mars is friend of the moon. But he gets debilitated in cancer.
You know, the big thing with this debilitation, exaltation story you get people making up reasons why a planet is debilitated or exalted in these placements. And nothing has validity. Those debilitations and exaltations are older than anybody remembers. They're in the ancient Babylonian clay tablets, those debilitation and exaltations. They're like old school. So, you know, when we start reasoning about friends and enemies, it's they're working on a very different level. So you know, you want to apply your logic there. It's the wrong. It's not the logic to be applied. Proper logic, I couldn't give you the correct answer, but I can cut down about 25 of the theories that are out there, and I can give you good reasons why those theories are, you know, are not accurate based upon certain textual references and things stated. There's some people that talk about, you know, about the stars, the actual stellar formations that are actually related to those positions. There's some academic opinions about the about, you know, there's this one text, a Babylonian text, that talks about the founding of a temple of Mercury. And I don't know if you know about Mercury in Babylonian religion.
No.
So Mercury was one of the main gods in Babylonia. And Jupiter was, I don't want to say secondary, but in many situations, Mercury was one of the, was a very primary deity. And they connected him with as the god of astrology. The Babylonians. And as we know that, you know, they were a completely astronomical, astrological culture. So the god of astrology has a very big, important role. And there's one tablet that talks about the erection of the number, the main Mercury temple, and I want to say Nebuchadnezzar, because Nebu is his name. And Nebuchadnezzar is named after Nebu, worshipper of Nebu. And the chart for the inauguration of that temple has all the planets in their exaltation. And so there's a debate, well, did they just happen to do it on that day? Or, you know, are the exaltations based upon where the planets were on that day? So there's a whole nother theory on that realm, you know? Uh-huh. When we look at Abraham Ibn Ezra, have you heard of him?
No.
He's a medieval author. And he's an interesting one, because what he does is he's a Jew who writes in Hebrew, and he writes texts in Europe. You know, as a job, he would go to different courts and he'd say, I'll write you a book on astrology if you pay me X amount. And they'd pay him, and he'd write a book, and then he'd go to different, you know, that's how he made his money. And he gives various discourses on the exaltation points. And he says, you know, the Greeks believe this, the Babylonians believe this, the Hindus believe this. And so we see that, you know, in the 10th century in Europe, we have a Jew who's telling us the difference between what the Greeks believe and what the Indians believe. It's pretty, you know, interesting historical fact there that, you know, shows that, you know, the Indian consciousness was completely in Europe being shared at in the 10th century. And, you know, he talks about, he goes into depth. He's like, well, if you take the space in between the exaltation of the sun and the exaltation of the moon, that's where the light in the zodiac is. If you look at the space between the debilitation of the sun and the debilitation of the moon, that's the darkness in the chart. And so everything is between this light and this darkness, right? So there's another theory, you know? This.
Yeah.
If you look at my discussion of the exaltation and debilitations in this book, it's not why they are exalted and debilitated. It's more giving what is the qualities of these exaltation and debilitations. You know, how can we have some images? Yeah. How can we have some images to interpret them? So yeah, so I'm not giving a reasoning. I'm giving a interpretation.
But I think the, and sure, you're using this too as a reasoning for why, I mean, like, you know, Mars being debilitated, but it's in a friend sign. I mean, that seems like two contrasting kind of.
Doesn't even matter, friend or enemy. No, there's no relationship.
Okay.
But doesn't it more have to do with Cancer being so emotional and nurturing and Mars being so destructive and emotional and destructive?
That is not
like, Mars can't do its thing very well in Cancer. Mm.
So it's important that we differentiate what is the result of it versus what is the cause of it. Because if we said that's the cause, then we should be able to apply the same logic to every single planet in its exaltation and debilitation, and it doesn't work. So you know what you just said, that's what happens because Mars is debilitated there.
Because when you think of Saturn and Venus, you wouldn't think that makes sense.
Exactly.
But if you follow that thinking, it wouldn't make any sense.
Exactly. So the reason, the why, nobody is given, and nobody to that I've seen as of yet has a reason, either from the historical perspective or from the astrological perspective.
But what I was following is like, is a planet happy in that environment?
Mm-hmm.
That's where I was thinking from.
Well, the thing is,
like you were saying about the sun being in Aries, that's a very, you know,
but the thing is, the difference between cause and effect. When I say that the sun likes to be there, it's an effect. It's not going to be the cause. Because if we applied the same logic of why I said, you know, the sun likes that there, if you apply it to the other planets' exaltations, you won't see the gunas line up. The gunas don't, you know, if you try and use gunas, it won't line up. If you try and use friends and enemies, it won't line up. If you try and use functionalities, it won't line up. Like, none of that logic works. And there's a much deeper, deeper logic. And as I said, you know, we see this exaltation and debilitation showing up in the earliest records in Babylonian clay tablets. So it's extremely old science.
But it's not articulated?
No, not articulated.
Been lost?
It's at the moment it's lost.
If Sanji doesn't know it either.
You know, he gives various reasonings, but he also, you know, he won't claim to state the cause, the root cause and the reason.
Mm-hmm.
He'll give you reasons for you to be able to remember and interpret. And,
for me is every person's chart that I, many people's chart that I see with Mercury and Pisces, they're way beyond everybody intellectually. Like Einstein. And recently I saw somebody else, I don't remember who it is, but they're always way beyond, but yet they've got Mercury and Pisces.
Einstein had Nietzsche Bunga, right?
Yeah.
Was it retrograde?
There's bungas and all kinds of things. And
was it retrograde? Was Einstein's Mercury retrograde?
I don't remember the exact ones, but either way, yeah, there's a lot of stuff in there.
Just to note, and I'm just, you know, I have my edited version right here for this. This will be the next one of these days when I come out with a new version of volume one. I have tons of edits to have another edition where it's going to have a cover that matches volume two. But who knows when that'll happen. But just I'll read you a little footnote that's in the next version. And it says, in the Book of Reasons by Ibrahim Ibn Ezra, verse 2, 16:9. He lists 3 degrees of Gemini as the exaltation of Rahu, and as the debilitation of Ketu. And he says, according to the Indian scientists. And now you don't find that 3 degrees mentioned in any, you know, Indian text. Yet here we have this Jew in Europe saying that the Indians say that the exaltation is 3 degrees of Gemini.
Is that what you're using for the differentiating between the 2 and 3 houses then?
Say that again?
Is that what you're using for, you brought up?
Oh, whether...
If a person has 2 or 3 houses when we were talking about that?
But the big thing is he gives us 3 degrees of Gemini, and that puts Ketu in Sagittarius. It doesn't put Ketu into Swakshetra. So it doesn't help answer that question. But it gives us a degree that we don't find in the Indian texts, which is a kind of a and yet he's referencing an Indian text.
Well, is it in that Indian text? Does that exist? Does that text still exist?
This is a Hebrew text.
No, but I'm saying, does the Indian text that he's referencing exist?
No. Doesn't exist. Doesn't exist anymore. And the Greek texts don't talk about degrees of exaltations of Rahu, so...
Well, how does it play out in people's charts?
It always works like gold, so...
Well,
there's
the answer.
But you know, I was just, the big thing is Frank was asking, he was using the logic of friendship and enemies. And I just did my best to destroy that logic is not what's to be applied here.
Because Mars doesn't see the moon as a friend. The moon sees Mars as a friend. But Mars doesn't see the moon as a friend.
Friends, enemies, it's the logic won't work. It's not the reason for the exaltation and debilitations. There's something else going on. Okay, Frank?
Okay, I'm good.
I don't really have any questions. All my questions have to do with my chart and Roland's chart.
Let's see.
Because that's where, you know.
You got one more, Frank?
I'm not going to bring that in here. I'm going to wait for my own sessions.
And I wanted to talk about your teeth, too, and what I was saying about when to and when not to. Actually, let's just talk about that real fast, and then we'll give Frank space for another one of his question lists. So, you know, we have this eclipse coming up on the 9th. 9th?
8th.
The 8th, yes. I was looking, I was like, wait a minute, I got readings on the 9th. How's that possible?
Because the 9th is the day when everything's okay.
Yes. I know, I just looked at my calendar and I'm like, oh my gosh, I got readings on the 9th. It's March 8th. So no readings on the 8th because, you know, you don't do readings on eclipses. New moons and eclipses, we're not supposed to do readings according to the tradition.
Okay. What about other things? Because I started to apply it to other things. I'm like, maybe it's not applicable to other things. Like, you know, working on a website. No, I'm not going to work on the website that
Won't. For new moon and eclipses, no websites.
I mean, the Astanga teacher cancels his classes on full moons, new moons, and anything.
Eclipses will only happen on new moons and full moons. So if he cancels on full moons and new moons, it's fine.
Right.
Yeah. The only cancel on full moon if you're going to be doing ritual and rituals getting in the way. It doesn't make it an inauspicious day to do readings. Just to differentiate that there. But this is a rule that I you know, from the Vedic, it's just telling us that it's inauspicious before an eclipse and it's inauspicious before a lunar or a solar eclipse. And they don't give us any exact times. There's a researcher, let me see his name. I'm not seeing the text right now. So I'm sorry that I'm not giving the name at the moment. But I'm not giving up just yet. Oh, well. All right. Bill Meridian. Bill Meridian is a guy who... He's a financial astrologer, and he published the writings of, the writings of an astrologer whose name was Jane. His last name is Jane. And it's Jane, J-A-Y-N-E. And this guy, Jane, I'm not seeing his full name, but his last name is Jane. Charles Jane. And Charles Jane spent his entire life studying eclipses. Entire life. I mean, can you imagine your whole life studying one thing? Just one thing in astrology only, huh?
But the thing, each time is a different moment. So yeah, I can see it's not, you know, redundant necessarily. Yeah.
So this guy, he lived pre-World War II and during World War II, and
where?
He was an American. And he spent his whole life researching eclipses. And it was at a time period before we had eclipse software like we do now. So he had to calculate them all by hand. He had to calculate the maps of where they were visible on the Earth by hand. Very intricate, you know. And then he studied the charts of countries, where that eclipse was in a country's chart, important generals and presidents, and where the eclipses happened in their chart. And he studied world events and what was happening. And he spent his whole life just researching nothing but that, you know. And his final diagnosis was 10 days before a solar eclipse, 3 days before a lunar eclipse. And there's nothing given in the Vedic literature that states those dates. But, and so I just, you know, there's, and one thing I say about bringing in non-Vedic stuff is there's nothing against bringing in non-Vedic stuff, but let's just be clear of the source of that information. Yeah. So this is Charles's Jane's research. This is not, you know, Varahamihira's. Yeah. And so his research showed 10 days before a solar eclipse, 3 days before a lunar. Anything done in that time basically is brought into the eclipse and causes issues. Operations during that time are going to just, things are going to go wrong. And in the end, you have literally the next 6 months of suffering from whatever went wrong. You know, if you start a business, it's going to be struggling for the next 6 months till the next eclipse. So, and there's other ways to calculate the exact length of when these things have an effect, which is most clearly discussed in Ptolemy. And Ptolemy does the detail breakdown of how to interpret the timing of an eclipse. And and we see all throughout India in the royal courts, the eclipses were really important, even all the way back to in Babylon. But so 10 days before a solar eclipse, avoid any type of operation or starting anything serious. And 3 days before a lunar eclipse, avoid any type of operation or starting something serious. And the key word is starting something serious. It doesn't mean you don't go to work. It doesn't mean you don't, you know, buy a loaf of bread. It doesn't, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
our general things can, but if you're going to start a new business that you want to like run for the next 10, 15 years, it's not the time to begin it. You know, so these things that we want to have long longevity, we don't begin during that time because their longevity is destroyed by that eclipse.
And so, then just what comes to my mind, yeah.
Yeah, and so, you know, when you were saying, but there's an infection, and the big thing is then we have to weigh the thing. Like, if you wait, is the infection itself going to cause more problems than anything that can happen in the operation all the way through? Or is it not that big of a deal that I can wait till after the eclipse so that it's done and taken care of and it doesn't become a bigger problem?
I mean, what's practical?
Exactly. So we have to weave in practical with that. But at the same time, you know, right now, Jupiter, Rahu are conjunct. And let's see, they're going through which of your houses?
They're 4 degrees from each other.
Which house is it in your chart?
It's in 12th. My God, ever since K2 went into, and ever since the nose moved, expenses related to health and pets. 12th axis.
Jupiter Rahu conjunction is bad for teeth in general, and particularly when it shows up in the first or second house, it shows major, you know, in transit, it shows teeth issues becoming a problem. You have it's being activated in the 12th house, teeth problems, but it's, you know, that conjunction alone is doing it. And so, you know, that Rahu is this causer of teeth problems.
Well,
so you don't want him to pull you into a bigger problem in general, if you can wait.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to make sure I explained that conceptually.
I appreciate being able to receive this having the karma to receive this information. It's rare.
Yes.
You can even give the information, it'll be rejected. So I appreciate it. And once you said, if it's not a tumor and... you know, that it was in the time frame. I'm like, that's it. I'm not in that much, you know, yes, it's infected, but doing well, you know, so fine.
Yep.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you.
You're welcome. So you got another question, Frank? I was just asking Frank if he had another question, but you said you had.
No, keep going, Yama. Yeah, I just
thought of when you have fourth house issues and you're in a moon dasha, or you have the fifth house issues and you're in a Jupiter dasha, when you're in the karaka of the dasha of the house, that's related. I've never heard anyone talk about that. I just wondered.
Not specifically. We wouldn't make a prediction based on that. All right, so let's see. Yama, you're in the houses chapter.
Mm-hmm.
All right, and Frank, you're huh?
And you, someone finally explained the chart with the diamonds. Is that north or south?
The north.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I use
the diamonds. I'm starting houses.
You're starting houses?
Yeah.
All right. And with sign, let's see. There's nothing really for me to quiz you with the signs. I'm surprised Rasa and Rakta is the only question you had from the planet chapter. I was ready for a whole bunch of more Karka discussions.
I had to go over like all the notes I took and kind of dig a little bit, but that one's always been sticking out. I was kind of curious where, like with the medical significations on all the planets.
Mm-hmm.
Seems like you pull out a lot, and is that just based on general associations with like the body, Alpurusha, all that?
It's just general, based on body Purusha and Dhatu. Dhatu, dosha, and Mars is boils. You know, and Saturn, you know, all kinds of the Vata disorders that can show up there. And Sun, all these hot Pitta issues, and like this. You know, And, you know, when we go into Moon, you know, we're bringing in the reproductive system as well, because all these motherly organs. So bringing in like this. It's basically, I'm just speaking the words of the archetypal language.
Yeah.
But, you know, because people don't want just the plain archetype, they want something more specific to grab onto.
And I mean, I've read through this book a couple times already, so.
I know, I was just expecting a little bit more disagreement in there, so.
I'll look closer. The next time. if you want to fight.
No. I just didn't expect it. You know, I know you well enough that you know I expected a little bit more debate. Did you get all your questions though, in Frank, from so far?
Yeah, I mean, those are my initial questions. Okay. So, yeah, I mean,
good that you. I was expecting a lot more work from you. So since you're on the house chapter, Yama, I'm gonna give you a little quiz here.
Okay.
So I'm born with the sun in Virgo, and it's in the fourth house. You got
no,
that?
No, I did this on the bench at the market the other day, and yep. I had his rising in Gemini, and he's a Virgo. So I have to redo that. I really loved learning that, but I have to go over that.
Okay, well, slight quiz. Just very small, you know. I have a Virgo sun and it's in the fourth house. What time was I born?
I know that's I have to I. Early.
When is the sun in the fourth house?
I think six, 5 to 7 or something like that.
Midnight.
Whoa.
So it's nighttime.
House. If it was in the first house, it would have been that early.
If it was the first house, it would have been around sunrise.
Yeah. Okay. That's what I'm getting. Okay. Yeah. I read it and I understand it, but then it didn't sink in enough.
All right. Well, I'm going to quiz you next time, next Thursday.
Okay. That's good. I'm glad. Thank you.
And it's a real simple thing, but it you know, I'll tell you when you're sitting with somebody and they can just, you know, their sun is in a place and you know when it is and you can tell them the about time. They're like, wow, like it just brings a whole new faith and it makes it real to them. And
it makes it real to me.
Yes, yes.
I felt that in reading it, yeah.
And it just makes it so, you know, your brain has a, you, it
a
makes
real grasp
it,
on it.
A real grasp of what's happening, of what this chart actually means. You know, like, we're not just reading sun in the 12th house. We're reading sun born it. We're reading, you know, sun in the 12th house. You could say sun in the 12th house, or you could say people born around 9 o'clock. When somebody's born around 9 o'clock, they have low self-esteem issues. You know, they have suffering of like this, you know, because, you know, the sun is in the 12th house. So
in the PM, you're talking about PM.
I was talking about AM. 12th house is around 8 to 9, around, yeah, more like 7:38 AM. You need to study that a little bit more. So
yeah, I totally do. And you know what? I keep going and I would have forgotten to go back to that.
Mm.
Thank you.
Yes. All right.
I am curious, moving forward on the whole project I'm doing for you.
Yeah.
Do you want me to just keep going and maybe send you more a little down the road? Or
keep going, send me more down the road? Totally. Looks good so far. And
do you have a file from the Glory Das who's doing it that I could just see just for formatting purposes, or does it?
What you're doing is exactly what he did. It's perfect.
Okay. Cool.
Perfect. And and basically, as I said, you have everything so far, Katya, except Katya Payati, everything is in Parashara. So you can have a, what do they call that when you're given a list and you have to go find it? It's a
treasure hunt.
You got a treasure hunt. A treasure hunt in Parashara. And let's see, I'll pull that up again real fast. My gosh. Doesn't even show up on the page anymore, Frank.
I condensed it because it's.
Oh no, you're good.
I tried to condense it as much as I could. So
sign aspects explained. That's in the first drishti chapter of Parashara. Planets aspects same signs as those they're in. That's in that same chapter. Argala concept introduced. There's a whole. It's called the Argala Adhyaya. So there's a whole chapter in Parashara just on that. Malefic sign, that's all in that. All that Argala stuff is in that same chapter. Planet with the highest longitude. That is showing up. Where's that show up in it shows up either in either at the end of chapter. It has to show up before the Atma Karka, the Karka Adhyaya. So the Karka Adhyaya is a whole chapter just on interpreting what the Atma Karka does. So which that entire chapter in Parashara is located in Jaimini, or the entire section, the Karka Adhyaya, the Argala Adhyaya, Bhavapada Adhyaya, they're all the same there.
I might just go through Jaimini first and then go back to Parashara.
Either or. Mercury signifies uncles, aunts. That's going to be in chapter 3. Find the sign Dasha periods by counting from the sign to its lord. That's going to be in most of the books where they print Parashara in two volumes. That's going to be in the Rashi chapter, not the Rashi chapter, the Dasha chapter in the second volume. That correlation right there. The exceptions to the rule are also there. The Dasha calculation, all that. Aruda Lagna, full chapter on that. All right. So all that. Everything is there, and I gave a little help, if that helps at all, for where that's located. All right. Good. 5 more minutes.
Okay, I got one more. Oh, did you ever read that article I sent you about original Parashara?
Original Parashara.
It was referencing the whole Jaimini Parashara connection, and there was a guy who was saying he was from a Jaimini lineage and saying don't use
anything. I didn't read it, and let's see, where did you send that to me? But I looked at who it was.
I sent it to you right after we talked. So yeah,
I'm just looking for what media it was sent through. Was it sent through Skype?
No, it was on an email.
It was on an email.
If you just Google original Brihat Parashara, it'll come up.
Yeah.
Pretty easy.
Yeah, I know the guy, and he is a student of one of the official Jaimini lineages, but what he said, I can't say I agree with still. And, it's not Sanjay's teaching, and from my understanding, it's not what his teacher actually teaches, but that's what that's what he says his understanding of the teacher is. So, and honestly, I can't argue with him because he knows his teachers more than me, but from what Sanjay said, that's not my understanding.
Yeah.
So, whether he's putting his own opinion on it versus his teachers, it's kind of a little, shaky there. But he is from an official lineage.
So yeah, that's what I thought.
Yeah. The Arungacharya lineage. Mm. All right. Was good talking to you both. You're kind of, it's kind of nice only having two people here.
Super for us.
Yes.
I got right, yeah. Thank you.
Yeah.
I wish my face was working.
Hopefully it will next time. And let's see. And as I said, the other two people, they're not starting. They said they needed a break for another 2 months. And there's a guy from Virginia. Oh, maybe that's why he didn't write me back. He's Virginia. It's going to be so late right now.
Yeah. Mm,
I'm going to have to set up some other time for him at a different. Yeah. Oh, any which way, I'll work on that. All right. It was good talking to you both. I'll talk to you again next Thursday.
Wonderful.
And I might not send out the invite sometimes till a few hours before, but unless I say it's not happening the next Thursday, just assume that same time the following Thursday. Okay. So assume that it's happening unless it's stated otherwise. Okay. And
thank you.
Yes.
It was great.
Take care.
Yeah.